Hello, my name is Mark Borst, founder of Make Impact Mondays, co-founder of Impact Club here in Northwest Indiana, and host on today's episode of Ask NWI, where we continually seek out the brightest minds and the biggest hearts in our local community and offer them chance to share their story with you, the audience, the place to come for all things region. In today's episode, we are behind the scenes with Kathy Braxton and Tammy Newman of Dementia Raw. We are in their co-working space at Green Cow. In today's episode, we learn a lot about the definition of dementia and the signs of dementia. And the one big thing that I took away from this episode is there is no outward signs. We can't tell a person with dementia from just looking at them. So we learn how to cope with people with some memory deficiencies in this episode. It was very eye-opening. We went down a couple rabbit holes on the whole spectrum of Alzheimer's, and it's a very informative episode. I hope you'll listen to it. Please enjoy the show.
Welcome to the show. Thanks for inviting me here to the Green Cow space.
Yay. Thank
always
you for having
happy
us.
Happy to have somebody. Yeah.
Yeah.
Cool. So I always start every podcast just kind of a personal introduction of you two as individuals. So go, one of you go first and then follow
Kathy
up.
Gets to go first on this one.
Oh, you're so kind. Okay. So I'm Kathy Braxton. I am the Chief Education Officer of Silver Dawn Training Institute. We've been at this for a little over 4 years now. And prior to that, I've been in the long-term care industry for 23 years, working exclusively with persons who live with dementia and the older adult who has any kind of need, whether it's anxiety, depression, or even needs such as, you know, financial needs and stuff like that. So I started off in the industry as an activity coordinator and activity aide back when I was 19, fell in love with the population, and then have just moved within the industry since then. And my specialty, I would say, is more in the social work realm.
Okay.
That's me.
Cool.
Yeah.
I'm the chief operations officer. So I'm the one that washes all the dishes and I put them away. That's the one that I am. So my background is I've been in the industry, the senior care industry, for about 25 years. And I've done a little bit of everything and worked in about every aspect of it. My track was a little bit more administration. All of my education is in being a nursing home administrator. I actually never decided to do it because when my kids were very young and I was going through all the schooling, they were young. I was a single parent. And if the nursing home is burning down, I have to go to it. And I didn't feel like dragging two little kids to a burning building. I thought that was counterintuitive. I don't know. But I did everything. I started out as activities, as she did, and have worked in this industry for 25 years. I have done a podcast previous, Conversations in Care, for 4 years that really was focused on caregiving, dementia, diabetes, that type of thing. And then we started this business. And personally, I'm a single mom. I have two adult children that live in my house and a dog named Russell.
Cool. All right. So let's just jump right in. Dementia Raw. You said 4 years about?
Yes.
So kind of tell us what that's all about and what was really the driving motivator that brought you from where you guys were to this venture?
Yeah. So I'm going to talk driving motivator first.
Okay.
And, you know, Kathy's been in the industry 23 years. I've been in it 25. When I started out in the industry, we were doing something that was referred to as reality orientation for persons living with dementia. So what that meant was I was supposed to tell the person with dementia, no, it is 2018, not 1920. No, your husband has passed away, right? And you can't see under the purple hair, but it's all gray. And I got all that gray hair from reality orientation because it made me uncomfortable pulling someone out of what their reality was. And it seemed harmful to do that. And I think as we go back into many of the communities that we go and see in the year 2018, you guys can do the math of 25 years ago when I started. But when I go into a community now and I see reality orientation still happening or the inability to connect or to communicate with a person with dementia, it horrifies me that we have not made the leap to doing something different and better. We need to be better. I'm going to step off on a little small soapbox. I happened to be watching the talk yesterday, and Sherry Shepherd, she's one of the hosts of the talk. They were talking about something that happened, and I won't get into the news story, but she was talking about how she herself pays for care for her sister who's disabled. And she said, I pay $250,000 to give care to my sister. She's like, I'm able to do that. And that's why I grind so hard. I'm doing so many things because I want to pay for great care for her. She's like, but we're failing at this. We're better as a society in the United States than what we're giving to people on a day-to-day basis. And I think that's what that driving force is for us, is that we need to be better in this industry. I'll step down off the soapbox. Sorry, I got a little...
Don't trip.
Don't trip. Don't fall too hard, right?
So how we started is we actually created a method and we decided to trial run it in a small suburb of Chicago called Blue Island. And what we wanted to do is we really felt it was important that tools to connect and communicate efficiently and effectively were at the tip of your fingers. We felt that something had to be accessible regardless of the age that you were at personally or the education level you had, that it shouldn't just be professionals who've gone and have a bachelor's degree in psychology or have worked in an industry for 20 years. It shouldn't just be those people who know how to communicate with a person living with dementia. Yes. It should be everyone. So where we started is we rolled out this program with first responders, police, medic, and fire in Blue Island, and we put them through the Dementia Raw training. And our goal was, this is an exclusive population, and this is a population who needs tools in their back pocket that they can access right away in a crisis. That these type of people who are working in this field don't have the ability to call back to dispatch and get a long history. They don't have the time to read a file or a chart while they're driving the ambulance to the site. They need to be able to get to that crisis and then de-escalate it in a very effective and positive way. And what we were seeing is that that wasn't happening. So we created the Dementia Raw method and then took it to this population and worked with them there in that city. And we had great success. We had 100% compliance of everyone, including the building department in that city, because they really truly felt Blue Island and the alderman there and the mayor, we had a lot of support that they wanted to be a senior friendly city. And what they felt was the first step in that was making sure all of their first responders had really good communication training. So that's how we started.
Yeah, that's how we started. And I think the concepts that we use within the Dementia Raw method are kind of unique because we felt that there are some programs out there that you have to go through 25 steps in working with the person with dementia. And I don't know about you, if I go to step 4 and I skip step 6, then I get caught in that. And I'm like, oh shit, what was step 5? And I got to go back. And do I have to go back to number 1? And you know, it's like playing a game of Monopoly. You know, do I collect the 200? You
know,
go to jail. I don't know what that is, right? So we felt that there was a way that people could have something in their back pocket. And, you know, I happened to be watching my son doing improv classes and realized, oh my gosh, here's the tools right here. So, and we even say, if you take one of these rules of improv, even just one, and remember that, you're going to be successful in connecting with the person with dementia. Actually, you're going to be successful connecting with anybody in your path.
Right.
And I was just going to say, so a first responder is not necessarily going to know that someone has dementia or doesn't,
right,
but
right.
They're going to be able to use these skills no matter who they're encountering.
Yes.
And that
is
key to us because what we focus on, our niche is communication. And the Dementia Raw method is based on two things. It's a melding of the pillars of empathy and then 4 basic rules of improv. So a first responder isn't going to know if someone has dementia related to Parkinson's, dementia related to Alzheimer's disease, that they've just had a stroke. Maybe they just came back from the hospital. Maybe there's schizophrenia involved. Or maybe it was just a really bad day.
Right.
A food allergy or a crisis.
Or maybe it was just a bad day.
Exactly. It doesn't matter. To be able to communicate effectively, none of that should matter. And so that is why our niche is in communication. We don't talk extensively about the neurology of the brain, the ins and outs of what's happening inside the anatomy of dementia per se. We talk about communication techniques because it shouldn't matter. It really shouldn't matter.
No, it shouldn't. Because we truly do feel that someone that's 9 years old can still continue to connect with grandma, grandpa, aunt, uncle without knowing what's happening in the brain.
Right. So the method that we have is something that, again, is accessible and attainable regardless of age or education. And the goal for that too is because more and more older adults are coming up within the population, living longer, being a part of our society. And either we're inviting them to live into our homes as the adult children,
right,
or we're bringing our children with us when we go visit and provide care. We cannot leave the smaller people in our lives, the younger people in our lives, out of this. And that is another driving force, I think, amongst us was, we often talk about that sandwich generation. Mm-hmm. And the sandwich generation exemplifies,
there we go,
that there's stress because we're leaving something out. We have...
Well, you're doing this.
We're doing that, right? We have the and older adults, right? And we have us as the adult caregiver. And then there's all this mishmash in between. And that mishmash in between is our family, our children. And if we can't create a communication technique that they can use too, then we're doing a total disservice how we move through this as a culture and as a society.
Absolutely.
So everybody needs to be involved. That's why empathy and improv is so simple for everyone to attain.
Yeah.
And I just want to put a quick pause. So why don't we actually define what dementia is?
Cool. All right. So dementia is not a diagnosis in itself.
Never.
And we often, never. Sorry. Yes. No, that's good. And we often, we're still getting hit with this question often. We equate this to the concept of cancer. If you were to walk into your doctor's office and get results from a test and the doctor were to say to you, you have cancer, and then they were to walk out, your next question before you let that doctor walk out should be...
Yeah, what do you think that should be?
Right.
So if your doctor says you have cancer, what would your next question be?
What kind?
Exactly.
Absolutely, yes.
Okay. Right, so cancer itself isn't a diagnosis. It's the type of cancer that's the diagnosis. And how we treat those types of cancers are very, very different. Prostate cancer, breast cancer, brain cancer, all of them very, very different. But a lot of adults are walking out of their doctor's office thinking that dementia is the diagnosis, and it's not. Dementia is just a grouping of symptoms. So dementia is basically an umbrella term that houses all of these symptoms. And underneath that umbrella are all the different types of dementia that there are. One of the prevailing ones is Alzheimer's, but there are...
There's many. Right? What we see mostly is Alzheimer's disease. So that they say, at some point they said about 68 to 70% of the cases are Alzheimer's. However, I bet you that that's going to change as we're getting better at diagnosing.
Right.
And we're starting to see that because we're starting to see more people with Lewy body dementia, with frontotemporal degeneration, those types of things are starting, we're starting to see more of that because we're better at diagnosing now. So, you know, there's over 70 different types of dementia, and memory loss is in Alzheimer's the hallmark piece of that, right? However, in something like Lewy body dementia, memory loss comes towards the end of the disease, but it's things that, that are behavioral issues or processing issues that come before that.
Exactly, exactly. So in knowing that, that is going to help a clinician and the family work through whatever type of
medical interventions, I think that
is necessary, because you wouldn't put a person who has frontal temporal dementia on the same medication that you'd put on someone who has and was diagnosed with Alzheimer's disease. Yeah. You absolutely would see counterintuitive.
Yeah, you can see different reactions. So it's super important that, and the unfortunate thing is so many general practitioners still are giving that diagnosis of dementia and not giving the family a referral onto neurology. And it's so important to have a neurologist go that next mile to find out what type of dementia it is. Because like she said, if we're giving the wrong medication to the wrong diagnosis, bad things will happen.
Absolutely.
Right.
Yeah, so, I had a friend whose father they thought was suffering from early onset Alzheimer's disease.
Right.
Had many, many symptoms that mirrored that. He called me, we counseled him, we talked to him. But one of the biggest things we did is we talked to him about how to communicate with dad. And then we said, get to a neurologist. And when they got to the neurologist and figured it all out, they actually found out he had a brain tumor and only had 3 months left to live. And that shifted everything in regards to the type of care that they wanted to provide him. Now it was a shift into quality of care for the rest of his life, whatever that meant. That meant calling in the troops, having family come and visit. It might be their last time. And they were able to give him comfort in those last months rather than just walking out of a doctor's office unknowing, possibly giving him a medication that wasn't going to work, and then have a potential death happen just out of the blue without really having any awareness. So knowing what type of dementia you have is critical to the care that you're receiving. Absolutely. On a medical perspective.
Yes.
So from that initial doctor visit, why, I guess I'm confused on the medical mm-hmm. profession. If you have something going on with your brain, why wouldn't you go to the specialist or the neurologist? I mean,
you know, that's a really good question that we would like answered.
Yeah, okay. I mean, we'd love that. I mean, I think, well, we've even had neurologists diagnose just dementia as well, which has been
frustrating. Yes.
I think one of the things that we see is the older adult has a doctor, a general practitioner they've seen for many, many years.
For
and
a very
they
long time.
Rely on that. I know where they are. I know where they're located. I've been to them forever. They've been really good to
me. He's been my doctor for 50 years.
Exactly.
All that.
And that's unfortunate because the older doctors who may not be keeping up with the newest research in all this are implementing the proper terminology. And then we're seeing that population go and visit that same doctor over and over and over again. And just be, again, the older population is much more willing to take doctors' word as that,
as gospel.
That is God.
Yeah.
God spoke and I
was gospel
away.
And
they don't question as much as the younger adults like us do.
Right.
We walk out and go, wait a minute.
Yeah. I think we're going to start seeing that change as our baby boomers get into this and drop into this. You know, they're going to be asking those questions. They're much more looking for the information and educating themselves on it.
Yeah. There's, I mean, self-advocacy is growing for us. It wasn't such a big a quality in that older adult
now, I think.
The other thing is that I think kids don't want to dismiss what's going on with a parent. We talk to a lot of caregivers, family caregivers, and one of the things we hear them saying is, you know, maybe mom's just having a bad day. I certainly don't want to write her off as having a disease. So, well, she's just forgetful. Well, she's just so-and-so-and.
There's a lot of denial that goes into this getting a correct diagnosis.
And from the family more than the person.
Spouses, sometimes. I see this a lot, and I know you do too, that
spouses.
We really compensate. Mm. Spouses will compensate for each other. And so oftentimes the children who aren't living there anymore don't see the magnitude of the problem going on because the one spouse who's not having any memory issues is going to do everything they can to kind of cover up and compensate for the one who is. So then you come for Thanksgiving dinner and you don't really see what's going on.
Right, right. Absolutely. Mm-hmm.
So you guys have both been in about 25 years. So is it just the fact that there's the baby boomers are getting older, that it's more prevalent, or is it just being more talked about now than it was even 10 years ago?
You know what? That's a really good question. I think it's a combination of things. I think it's definitely, you know, the baby boomer generation is huge. It's referred to as the silver tsunami, even though that's not what we like to refer to it. We refer to it as the silver dawn. So there's a ton of people, right? There hasn't been as much research put into Alzheimer's and dementia as cancer, things of that nature.
Correct.
So it has, you know, it doesn't have a long history of understanding. So it used to be things, you know, she was just senile. She's an old lady. And she's just senile, or, you know, oh, she's that crazy lady down the street. I think we'd never had a great definition or diagnosis. We just said it was old age, right?
Right.
Or hardening of the arteries or different interesting things that were said. So we're getting better at spotting it and knowing the difference between normal aging versus something as dementia. And now we have a big boom of people that we're going to see that have this disease.
I think additionally, because of that information and all the knowledge that now is coming up,
right,
we have people who are in the spotlight, celebrities who are talking about and taking the shame away from it. I think that it was such a place of shame. We would hide the grandma that had the senile Alzheimer's, as they would say.
Right.
We'd hide her in the closet and wouldn't talk about her. And now we have celebrities who are campaigning and pretty much putting all of their efforts towards talking about it and dispelling the myths.
Well, and then on top of that, we now have people that have been diagnosed with some type of dementia that are becoming celebrities in their own right because they're sharing their story. Mm. So they're taking away that shame and that feeling of shame about it and really sharing it. And we're getting more and more and more people sharing their own stories. Yeah. And it's so empowering for us to see that they're taking away that stigma.
Absolutely.
So it's an interesting layered pie.
Yes.
Or cake.
Yes.
Yeah. Whichever.
Parfait.
Parfait. Yes. Let's go with parfait.
So is it more of a just general doctor that is misdiagnosing or lack of diagnosing where it comes from versus the specialist? Is that?
I would say I'm going to make a guesstimate.
Go ahead.
I would say that a lot of it's more of the general practitioner that's making that dementia mm-hmm. diagnosis, because then what happens is they're not giving that referral to the neurologist and the family is not looking for that neurologist consult because they're like, okay, the doctor said I have dementia. So that's, I think, where it starts. The unfortunate thing is we are seeing some neurologists. We've seen through the family members that we've worked with, we've seen a handful of neurologists that stick with that dementia diagnosis. So, and that's disheartening to us because it's so imperative for us to really understand mm-hmm. what type of dementia that person has. Mm-hmm. So that's a good question.
And I think the medical field in general sometimes puts such broad things on it because I don't know if it's liability or what it is, but they put this broad thing on it and don't dig deep and go to the root cause of stuff.
Right. You know, and I think the other thing is, you know, when we look at it, the average amount of time that a doctor has with a patient in their room is about 7 to 8 minutes. So, and I think the other thing is that they don't want to make any assumptions because what they're seeing typically in that 8 minutes is someone that still looks really good. Right. They still, but they're not listening then to the family member that has this whole thing written out of, okay, mom lost her wallet. Mom got lost going to Walmart. Mom, you know, is repeating herself. So, you know, I think there's so many pieces to the puzzle that are just not being seen or worked with.
Absolutely. And I agree with you. I mean, the short amount of time that someone is spending in an office with someone.
They're on their best behavior.
They're on their best behavior. Yes, absolutely. I mean, you know this, right? Yeah. Your knee hurts till tomorrow when you go to the doctor's office. And then it's fine. And then you're like, what the hell? What is going on? I mean, I agree. Absolutely. And the older adult has always been, and they were trained to be on their best behavior when they visited the doctor. The doctor was someone to be revered. I think what's also interesting is there does need to be even further testing than a neurologist. And a neurologist should, if they really want to get to the root cause, they should be asking someone to go to a neuropsychologist as well. And that type of appointment can last 6 to 8 hours. Sometimes they'll even break it up over 2 days.
Right, absolutely.
Because they want to do really, a neuropsychologist will want to do some very extensive testing across the desk from someone. A lot of, you know, they're doing math.
Very specific.
Very specific. Spelling, reading, having math and numbers.
Processing.
Exactly. And then they can, from that information and then any imaging that they've had, put together as close to a proper diagnosis as possible. But a lot of people aren't going to go and do that.
Right. Yeah, because there's some interesting paper tests that can mm-hmm. be done. And one that I'm kind of referred to as the clock test. And the clock test is basically asking someone to write down on paper what a clock looks like. And depending on where they place things, we can now tell where in the brain that the damage is coming from.
Right.
So there's a lot of different tests out mm-hmm. there. And like she said, I mean, the neuropsych test is an amazing test because they're testing everything to see where the deficits are. And that can really get us closer and closer and closer to what type of diagnosis that they have.
Right, right.
And is it also a fact that we're living longer, so it's more prevalent as well?
Yeah, when it comes to dementia, and I'm going to speak specifically to Alzheimer's. Mm-hmm. You know, with Alzheimer's, we tend to see more women getting diagnosed with it because women tend to live longer than men. We tend to see, you know, people in their 80s and 90s getting it more. But we are now starting to see a small portion of the population getting diagnosed as young as their 50s or 40s. And this is with, you know,
on the Alzheimer's side, though.
On the Alzheimer's side, okay. Yeah. An early onset diagnosis. So, you know, we're starting to see that more and more. We're starting to have more and more people having these diagnoses and research behind it. And I think this is all going to, in the next probably 20 years, we're going to see much more because we have more people that we can actually do research with.
We can study.
So we can study, you know, is there a familial link, you know? Because we're starting to see things such as, you know, grandma had it and died in her 70s. Then that daughter had it and died in her 60s.
Mm-hmm.
And then that daughter had it and died in her 50s.
Exactly.
So we're starting to see some interesting things. And that may be anomalies, what I'm saying, but it may not be.
Right.
But we've never been able to put all this stuff in some sort of depository of information to really see where this research is going to lead us.
Right.
The
I think we're just starting to do longitudinal studies now because we have the access to that. And although testing can help you make the best determination based on the information you have at hand. Speaking about Alzheimer's disease, the only way to make a definitive diagnosis that you have that is actually through an autopsy. So you made a comment about liability, which I think is interesting. Are doctors leery to make that diagnosis of Alzheimer's disease because they know I could put a label on someone that is going to stick with them the rest of their lives? That could be 5 or 10 years.
Right.
And then we could find out after death through an autopsy that wasn't the case at all.
Right.
And do I want to be held liable for that? But the testing is getting much, much better to give us as much more information.
Yeah, the scans that we have now can get us much closer to knowing that it's Alzheimer's versus frontotemporal versus Lewy body. And there's 70 different types of dementia.
Versus a brain tumor.
Absolutely.
And then there's reversible dementias too, which again, that's really, I think one of our soapboxes we like to get on is have we ruled out things we can reverse?
Yes.
Are there vitamin deficiencies? Are there things going on in the environment that if we remove that, are we then going to see an increase in an enhancement?
Right. Is there a UTI?
Exactly.
Is the person on 20 meds that are counterintuitive to each other that are really causing memory loss? When if we start to clean out that closet of medication, will that cognition come back?
Right.
So it has to be a full frontal attack.
Absolutely.
Coming up
from
with this.
Multifunction.
Yeah.
Yes,
yeah.
Yes.
It does.
And not just let's talk to somebody for 7 minutes and then write a word on a chart.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I've kind of geeked out on the whole holistic thing the past couple years. It annoys the boys, and I think there is a lot to that kind of stuff if it isn't one of those things, you know. But the Alzheimer's, that's interesting that you can't officially diagnose it to autopsy. So what is the actual thing that you find in autopsy that triggers that diagnosis?
What you will see in specific areas of the brain are these, what they call plaques and tangles in the brain. So it's a tangling of neurons and kind of a mess. And then what that causes is like a big meshy plaque, like you'd have plaque on your teeth.
Right.
Or
right.
Plaque in your arteries. It's very, very similar. And so those are the hallmark signs of Alzheimer's disease. We don't I don't think we have any scans that can detect that per se.
We can't, but the scans can detect that the brain is starting to decrease in size.
Yeah, so we see atrophy.
So, yeah.
That's interesting. Yeah. So, but there's obviously no definitive cause of it's not genetic, it's not outside source, that's not been determined at this point?
At this point, it hasn't been determined. There are some specific, very, very, very specific, and don't quiz me too much on this, that there is a familial link. So that there, but it's like in some remote places I think in the southern part of the universe, to be honest with you.
Yes, they've done some really long studies on that.
Right. So, but there's still not enough research out there that gives us an idea what actually it is that's happening. What we're seeing is that we're looking at risk factors, and what we're starting to see is the risk factors are starting to change. And one of the biggest risk factors that is really been coming about in the last couple of years, and something that we fully believe in, is this concept of sleep. So when we don't pay attention to our sleep, our brain is rejuvenating itself during sleep. And when someone is getting less and less sleep, what we're finding is that's one of the biggest risk factors to getting Alzheimer's disease now.
Right.
So
when you were growing up in the industry, one of the concepts was that it was a lower intelligence that was a risk factor for Alzheimer's disease. But yet you found over time that what you saw in your own personal longitudinal
study. This is my own study.
Right. Was that it was people who were actually incredibly intelligent and had degrees upon degrees and were people who were up through the night working and studying and doing their own research. And that was what they were doing in their jobs that precluded them from getting really good, decent sleep.
Yeah. Years ago, I want to say maybe it might have been around 10 years ago, there were some studies that came out that said that lack of education. So if you only got to a high school level versus a college level, that was one of the risk factors. And I kept questioning that because here I had this amazing psych professor that was someone that I cared for in one of the communities that I worked in. And I kept seeing this. I kept seeing all these really highly intelligent people. And I'm like, okay, to me, in my longitudinal study, this is bullshit, right? right? Mm-hmm. So when I started to hear about this concept of sleep and lack of sleep, I'm like, that makes sense to me, mm-hmm. right? That makes a ton of sense. You know, how many researchers are up during the night because they want to, or they've got a class the next day and they're only getting that 4 hours of sleep. And so I feel that that's going down the right path. And we have, you know, we're seeing studies that talk about how when we sleep, it's clearing away some of those plaques and tangles when we...
Right. Right. So there's a system in the brain called the glymphatic system, and it only turns on when you're in REM sleep, stage three sleep. It doesn't work at all during the day when you're awake. So what we're seeing is also that system is only runs, it's a flushing system, like a plumbing system. It works specifically in the areas where there have been identified plaques and tangles in people who develop Alzheimer's disease. So what you're seeing essentially is a plumbing system that is clogged up. So it's not working as effectively. And then what we find is that an older adult essentially doesn't get the quality of sleep that you and I get. They're woken up several times through the night for other reasons other than their dementia. They may have neuropathic pain. They may have to use the bathroom more frequently. They may sleep with a partner or a spouse that has sleep apnea and is snoring in their ear. They may have a roommate in their community that's up and about throughout the day or through the night and is disruptive. It may be us as nurses and CNAs walking in flashing lights, turning on with flashlights, checking on people. There are so many factors. And what's happening is that the older adult, whether they're in a community or not, they're getting less REM sleep. So they're in stage one and they're in stage two, but they're not in stage three. They're not there long enough for that flushing system to work. And then when they do get to that REM sleep and that flushing system turns on, it's not as effective.
Right.
So then the buildup of that, we see the next day and then the next day and the next day. And you know this, if you haven't gotten enough sleep, you're incredibly groggy and tired the day after. You might be cranky. You may have what we would term behaviors. We don't like that word, but you know, his dad's being a crank today or whatever. He must not have gotten his sleep. I mean, we joke about it, but there's true reality in that. Yeah. So people who didn't get adequate sleep as they were growing up, even in their young adulthood life, because they were professors or studying or stressed, whatever the case may be, we see that the risk of them developing Alzheimer's or another form of dementia is higher than once they have some type of dementia that they're suffering with. Even people who have Parkinson's disease, they're sleeping a lot less through the night. They need more rest, but they're not getting it.
Right.
And so the buildup of that happens day after day after day.
That's interesting. So it just kind of all...
Yeah.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. So get your sleep now.
Yes. Yeah. Do it. Be very protective of your sleep. Yeah. It's one of the things, and we're seeing a lot more research in that, but I can't tell you how many homes I've gone into where I see a sleep apnea machine, which is needed for someone who's snoring and getting disruptive sleep, sitting on a bedside table, closed up, collecting dust because people are afraid to use it. And so even someone who's been diagnosed and knows they need to protect their sleep isn't actively doing it once they get home.
Okay. So we've gone way down like into the what it is, which I appreciate.
We have.
Yeah. So let's bring it back to what you guys are actually doing, because you're not on the research side of the disease. You're trying to help people cope with people with that.
Right.
So let's go into that.
Cool. All right.
That's so funny. That's the most we've ever talked about research.
I know. So what we do is something called the Dementia Raw Method. And what we've taken, as I said before, is the four pillars of empathy. And then we've taken four basic rules of improv and we've meshed them together to create what is a very unique communication technique that can be utilized by anybody. Mm-hmm. So we train professionals, family caregivers. We've trained children as young as 9 through this method. And the goal is to get everybody who is a care team on the same page. So what we do in this training is it's inclusive and it's a lot of exploratory. We call it introspective improv. That's what we call it, because the introspective part starts with that empathy piece. And we ask people to really dive into themselves and go, what are my own personal hangups and how could that be affecting how I'm communicating with somebody?
Absolutely.
And so that's where we dive in deep. We get people crying. We know we've done our job when we've gotten some tears.
We sound so evil.
We do. But then they come out the other side, because then we say, we've broken you down. You faced your demons. You now know what are things you need to work on. And now we're going to give you some tools that are going to help exemplify what your strengths are.
Right.
And those are the improv roles.
Yeah.
So do you want to go into what they are?
Sure. Yeah? Sure.
So do we want to talk improv rules or do we want to talk?
So we'll talk about the pillars of empathy first. Should we do that?
Perfect.
Okay.
Perfect.
So we dive into the first four pillars of empathy. And the first pillar is perspective taking. So we not only say that's a great mantra to live by, but we actually breathe life into these concepts and we give people techniques and jobs and challenges.
We make people take on a new perspective.
We
force them to.
We force
that sounds
them
mean. I'm sounding
that's
mean.
That's where
right
the
now
crying comes from.
That's where the crying comes from. But we feel that this concept of perspective taking, not only is it a great part of empathy, but it's a great part for us to me, it opens up minds, right? Mm-hmm. So if you can start to take on a new perspective, then your mind is opened up to start taking in all the rest of the information that we're going to give you.
Exactly.
So we've created a set of what we refer to as dementia challenges, where we ask people to go out into the real world and do these challenges. So it's kind of a two-part process. Mm-hmm. So I'll give you a for example. One of our challenges, we ask you to go out to dinner. You go out to dinner, you're sitting with your family, and the waitress comes and she asks you, what do you want? And you have to look at the waitress for 10 seconds without saying anything. So number one,
ten seconds is
a long time.
That's huge.
It's huge, right? So what that does right there, that mimics the concept that it's hard for persons with dementia, specifically Alzheimer's, it's hard for them to find words, right? So it's mimicking that concept of I can't find words to say to you. The other thing that we want people to understand is that Alzheimer's, dementia, it doesn't just happen inside your house. It happens in the grocery store, happens in the dining place that you go to.
Called restaurants.
Thank you. I couldn't come up with that word. Where'd it go? It happens everywhere. And what happens is that you get some feedback from people when you can't find a word or you act differently than other people. So we ask you to sit in that and
see. So someone interjects like she just did with the word restaurant.
Mm-hmm. Right, right. So, and does the waitress freak out and start asking your partner, what does she want to eat? You know, how is that? And what does that, how does that make you feel? So we're asking you to take on what that could potentially be like for dementia. Then we want you to feel what the world is giving back to you, because that's such an important piece of it. And that's why we see isolation happen with seniors, especially those with dementia. That's why we see behaviors happen because of how people have treated the person with dementia. So it's a whole new world out there when we look at it through somebody else's eyes.
And I think the reason to take on this perspective is someone who's living with dementia but trying to maintain their independence for as long as possible doesn't look any different than you and I. Yet you see someone who comes into a restaurant in a wheelchair and automatically there are physical visual cues for us to know that we need to adjust the environment for them.
Right.
But when it comes to dementia, we don't do that. As a culture, we don't think we need to do that. And right, the minute we're faced, if I were the waitress, faced with something that felt anxiety provoking, what is my reaction? If I'm having a bad day, am I going to snap at that woman? Am I going to talk over her and ask right her spouse or someone else? And what does that feel like for that
person?
Am I going
to put my hand on my hip and start tapping my toe? You know,
exactly.
What am I receiving back? And I think it's really important for us to look at that.
And that's interesting that you said the outside influence, because I was just going to say, when our kids were little, we would always make them order their own food mm-hmm at the restaurant. And there always was that pause, mm-hmm, like, but... Like you just said, okay, the waitress sees they're a kid.
Right, right.
So they're going to be a little bit more patient exactly with it than an right adult that they looks just like everybody else.
Exactly. Right. Yeah. Right. There's no sign, visual sign to us
right
that something might be wrong right or that we need to be as patient as possible.
Yeah.
So that's perspective taking. So we make you dig really deep and step out of your comfort zone and try some stuff on.
And it's scary.
It's scary.
We have two that are easy, two that are medium, and two that are super hard.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And we love hearing the feedback that people get.
Yeah.
Love it. The second pillar of empathy is to stay out of judgment. And for us, we feel like that's nearly impossible because it's ingrained in us. Judgment is something that it's basically the essence of creating a bad story to remove ourselves from a place of harm. That's something that we did when we were cavemen. We developed that sense to save ourselves and save our clan. So it's not necessarily a bad thing, or at least it wasn't then. What it has become now is something that we utilize judgment and sit in it for a really long time with other human beings. And that creates disconnection and a breakdown in relationship. So then we ask people to dive into those concepts. And we have several exercises that we put people through mm-hmm. and case studies that we walk them through and have them kind of excavate. Oh, right. I can see where this person was very much in a place of judgment and unable to work their way out of it. So we talk about that. The third pillar of empathy is to recognize emotion. So in this one, we talk a lot about body language because only 7% of a package of communication is based in verbalizations. 58% is body language. And then the other 35% is tone of voice. So we don't put a lot of emphasis on how much our tone and our body language expresses to other people, but we really need to become aware of that. So we run our students through the paces of practicing body language, recognizing body language, and then knowing that I can pick up on someone else's cues, even if someone who is living with dementia and is nonverbal, I can still understand potentially what might be going on with them.
Right. Yeah. So many caregivers say, you know, they no longer can speak words or speak words in a coherent sentence. So there's no way I can connect with them. And I always say I call bullshit on that because we've got body language, you know, right. So much of what is happening. I mean, if you look at me right now, I'm really emphatic about this because my hands are going up and down, right? You know, I mean business right now. Uh-huh. So there's so much to that body language that you can take from it and that we can really learn to watch that and see what that person is really feeling and thinking. And if they're even in pain, because right. sometimes they can't verbalize they're in pain, but we can look at their body to determine if they are.
Right. And people who are living with dementia are hyperfluent to body language. Mm-hmm. Because their verbal skills are diminishing, they rely more on using their body to express how they feel. And they're also looking at our body language to understand the environment yeah. around them. So it's incredibly important mm-hmm. to start becoming more aware of that.
Right.
So we run
right.
our students through the paces of that. And then the fourth pillar of empathy is expressing that you understand. So now that you can recognize an emotion, can you express to someone that you understand that that's what they're going through?
Right, right.
And that is kind of, for me, where that rubber meets the road in regards to empathy is this is where a lot of us struggle. We don't know how to say to somebody, I understand where you are. I've been there too. I get it. We often want to fill that really uncomfortable space with words that mean nothing to someone. And very often we miss opportunities to just be in that uncomfortable space with someone, mm-hmm. let them cry on our shoulder, let them talk out their feelings. We don't like discomfort as a human race. So we remove ourselves from it and we will do things. And we've seen in communities, oh, don't worry, don't worry, don't worry about that. Let's go to bingo instead. Mm-hmm. So that's where we say it's really important to go first. Go through those first three and then step into that fourth one and practice it. And really the practice of that fourth pillar of expressing that you understand is where all the rules of improv come in.
Yeah. Yeah. So we'll talk about improv.
Sure.
How's that? Okay.
Yeah.
One of the coolest things to me about improv is that we often think that improv is about being funny. And surprisingly, it's not. Improv at its core is about communicating. So the woman that created improv, her name is Viola Spolin, and she actually, her son was the one that created Second City. And really what she was doing is she was exploring how people at play and things that we could do at play could help us to communicate with each other. So she started creating theater games to help people connect. And she actually worked with underserved youth within the city of Chicago. And she worked in an area where there are all sorts of different immigrants that lived in this area. So there might be someone that spoke Spanish, someone that spoke Polish, that spoke, you name it,
right.
a whole bunch of different languages. But she was able to help everybody connect, even though they may not know the native language of someone else. So her rules were a way for us to connect with each other and to communicate with each other. So at its core, even though what it's created is something humorous, at its core, it's all about communication. Now, depending on what camp you are in, if you're a Second City person or an IO person, you know, the rules kind of ebb and flow as to what they are. And there's somewhere between 10 to 12 rules, depending on which camp you decide to sleep in, right? But what we decided to do is we looked at four major rules that we feel really speak to communicating and connecting. And the very first rule that we talk about is something that we refer to as relinquish your agenda. And really that means that whatever my agenda is, I need to take it and set it aside and be one-on-one with that person. Because if I'm forcing my agenda, I'm not connecting with that person. And you see that on the improv stage, because two people that get up on an improv stage, they've thrown their agendas out, because when an agenda rears its ugly head, we can't move a scene forward in improv. So when we step back, throw our agendas out, and just be in the moment with someone, it's beautiful. The second rule that we talk about is make your partner look good. I love this one because to me, it's just a mantra that we should live by all day, every day, no matter who we're working with. And the concept is, am I, the things that I'm saying, the things that I'm doing, is it making you look good? Or am I using my body? Maybe the words are coming out right, but like she talked about, but my body language, am I making you look good? So it's this concept of consistently looking at how I am as a person in the universe, and am I making people look good? Mm-hmm. The third rule is where, to me, this is the rule that if you have nothing else, and this is the only thing you ever remember out of, I don't know how many minutes we just talked, if this is the only thing, it's going to get you somewhere. And it's, I'm sure every single improv person out there, you know the next two words that I'm going to say. So in your car, say them with me.
That's right.
Yes, and.
Yep.
So it's as simple as that. Two words, yes, comma, and dot, dot, dot. So yes means to be in agreement. That's all it means. And means to add something to it. So we talk about being in agreement in a couple of different ways. So it can be an agreement that's just verbally. So it could literally be yes, or it could be, that's a really cool idea. That's an agreement. We can be in agreement with body language. Like we just talked about, so many of our residents don't have those words anymore. But if I see a resident that's sad or a person with dementia that's sad sitting down, I can sit next to them and I can take on that body language with them and meet them where they're at. And it's amazing because then they'll connect with me. And I haven't said anything. It's just I took on and was in agreement with what their body language was saying. So we can be in agreement with words. We can be in agreement with our body. And then that third piece is where we're connecting that empathy back into it, is being in agreement emotionally. And this is where we fail consistently, is being in agreement emotionally with someone. And we need to be there first because before we can do the and part. So being in agreement. So say, for example, I'm going to make a statement to Kathy.
Okay.
And she's going to yes and the hell out of this. You ready?
Okay, I'm ready.
Okay. So, Kathy, I hear that your mom is the bearded lady at the circus.
She is an amazing act. She dyes her beard green and then she lets the munchkins braid it right before the show.
Oh, my God.
It's awesome.
So she was in agreement because she said she is an amazing act. That was the agreement part. The and part was she braids it, the minions, or I don't know who the
munchkins.
Oh, the munchkins. The munchkins braid it and it's green, right? So that was the and piece of it. So when we're looking at with the person with dementia, we need to be in agreement with emotions or words or things of that nature. And then add something to it. So oftentimes within senior care communities, we see someone and they might be down. And the automatic thing that we do is we take them to bingo, right? We didn't get into the emotions. And what happens is we take them to bingo, then they come back. We take them to coffee, they come back. We take them to something else because we never met them at that emotional need. So we need to be there. So once we can be in agreement with that, where they're at emotionally, then we can go and enjoy bingo with them. Then we can enjoy coffee with them. Decaffeinated coffee. That's another soapbox. Right. I'll leave it for another time. But, you know, that rule itself can really get you going. And we talk about all of this as a lifestyle and not something you turn on and off with the person with dementia. Because if I'm using this consistently, maybe you're my customer, you're come in, I use it with you. I use it. I don't have a husband, so I won't use that analogy. But, you know, I use it with my kids. I use it when I'm in the grocery store. It's a constant thing that I'm using so that when I am with the person with dementia, I am able to do it without any problems. I don't have to then go, oh, okay, now this is what I need to do, right? It's very natural. It becomes natural. Now, the very last rule of improv that we utilize is something that's referred to as the gifts. And we look at this as a couple of things. We look at every piece of communication that a person with dementia gives us as a gift. So even if they're crying, even if they're screaming out, even if they are having what is termed in some realms as a behavior, that's a gift to me. That's a gift telling me something. So is it telling me that I didn't handle the situation right? Did I use words that were wrong? Was my body language saying something? Are they giving me a gift that they're in pain and I need to figure that out? So we look at everything that they do as a gift. And we often look at behaviors with persons with dementia as very negative, that we have to get rid of them.
Right.
But to us, we don't want to get rid of them because that's telling me something, right? And once I can introspectively look at what I've done or what's around in the, I was going to say atmosphere, but
environment.
Environment. What we can see in the environment, then we can look at how we can be better at those reasonable reactions with that person, and they'll start to diminish on their own because we've changed the way we are.
Right. So the change comes from us, not from
them. Yes. That's right. Huge.
The big focus is to extinguish behaviors by trying to cause someone to do something else. And the reality is the people that need to change are us.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And then, you know, our gifts that are given to them as well.
Exactly. Exactly. So.
And you just alluded to it, but I mean, you guys are specifically going towards the dementia aspect, but these are things that are everyday life that all of our relationships would be better if we
absolutely
acted that way.
Yeah, we're looking at expanding it to the MMRD population. I have a 18-year-old son who just realized that.
How old is he
who
now?
Has autism. I mean, we in the house use this all the time. This is a common language within my household.
Right.
If something doesn't go well with my son, either I'll talk with my husband or my daughter and we'll say, did we yes and him? Oh, no, we didn't. Did we make our partner look good? You know, we'll talk about that. Or we'll say things such as, you probably want to relinquish your agenda right now. And it's, again, this shorthand that can be used by everybody that doesn't put any shame or judgment in how we behaved.
It's
really
neutral,
just,
yeah.
It's very neutral. It just puts us, it just resets us and go, oh, need to refocus on that.
Right.
And, you know, I'm not always really good at yes-anding. And I have to get reminded oftentimes, Mom, you didn't yes-and him at all. And I'm like, oh, okay. But that's a learning experience for me. That's a gift to me.
Yeah, absolutely. And we're also looking to work with the Down syndrome population because with that population, they already have the plaques and tangles that can lead them to getting Alzheimer's disease specifically. So, and there really wasn't much, we weren't really seeing this much in the population because the population now is
getting older.
So we're starting to see this more and we're starting to work with some groups in regards to this population. And I think this is a perfect match for them.
And what's cool too is, like you said, you know, it does work for everybody. And so there's multiple care partners often involved with taking care of somebody who's living with dementia or any illness whatsoever. And so I'm going to use the rules of improv and yes and make my partner look good. I'm going to use that with Tammy if she were my sister and we were working with Mom. So it's just as important for me to utilize these concepts with my care partners as it is to use with the person who is living
absolutely
whatever is going on at the time.
Yeah, it's definitely something that to strive for for everything, for all communications.
Yeah, absolutely.
So you guys talked about to learn this, to push yourself out of your comfort zone and to get out there. How has that been received by the people that you're teaching? Do they like to go out of their comfort zone? Is that a big pushback point?
There's a mix.
There's a big mix.
Yeah.
So in regard specifically to those dementia challenges, there's a lot of people that, because we have a certification, it's called the Certified Dementia Communication Specialist. So when you go through that certification training, you have to do at least three of them to get your certification.
Mm-hmm.
And people come to class and they're like, I'm afraid. I'm not going to do it. I'm afraid. Right?
Right.
But then you have some people that just dive into this and like geek out about how to do this, right?
Yeah, we have a student who is dedicated this week to the Dementia Perception Challenge Week. She's doing one a day.
Yeah.
And every day she's posting
what
her
she's
feedback
done. Yeah.
has been.
Yeah, it's pretty interesting. Yeah. You know, but I think when people get into our class or into our workshops, a couple of the things that we do is everything's highly interactive. So you're not sitting with us, you know, where we're just talking like this and reading off a PowerPoint and people want to poke themselves in the eye with a fork. So we don't do that. Yeah. And it's highly interactive where we give them things that, you know, maybe our words are not hitting at home, but when we do this activity, they're like, ah, I get it. And we spend time with them to really get comfortable in the roles of improv as well. So I think that's where we turn the corner and people absolutely then love what we do.
Absolutely. I mean, we've gotten nothing but great feedback when people go out and step out and do these. And again, as you said, there are two that are easy. So they're more introspective. So they actually don't even You don't even have to step out of your own home to
try.
Well,
one, you kind of do.
Okay.
Because you have to write, I have Alzheimer's.
This is true. This is true. But it's fairly passive.
Yes, it is passive.
Fairly passive. So we did that so that people can dip their toe in and start to get comfortable with it. And we let people kind of adjust. So there's several we have where people have made adjustments. So again, one of them is I have Alzheimer's on my hand, and you write it on your hand and you wear it on your hand for the day. And you just take inventory as to what kind of reactions you were getting from the public.
And you show that to other people?
It's just on your hand. You can walk around with it. Some people write something and label themselves and says, I have Alzheimer's. And the reason we do that one is it once you get the label of something, right? You get a diagnosis of dementia or Alzheimer's. Now you feel like this big label has been placed on you. And what does the world perceive you as? So that's kind of the goal of that one.
The Scarlet Letter.
Yes, very much so. So that one's, you know, and it's kind of like that thing, like, you know, are they really reacting to this or am I more hyper vigilant of it because I have this on me, right? Mm-hmm. So it's, you know, what does that mean, right? So, but it's very important to take on that perspective.
Exactly.
It really is.
Right. And once people do it and they step into it, they boast at how helpful it was. Because we've done sensitivity trainings in the past where we're in a room like this. It's a closed room. We're all peers. We all try on the same type of glasses or put on the same type of headphones. And we go through activities and we kind of joke and laugh and we experience something. But it's very difficult to take that experience and then extrapolate that out into the community. Because we as peers all experienced it at the same time.
Right.
So what we've done with the Dementia Perception Challenges is said, what we have to do is take this out into the world. And we have to see what real-time reaction people are getting.
Right.
Because that's the true tell. When we wonder why Uncle John won't go to the VA anymore to visit his pals in the evening or go to his special restaurant on Friday mornings, and we start to question why is someone isolating themselves at home, this gives us an opportunity to look at and go, was there something that happened in the environment that they got from the neurotypical people, us in society, the feedback they got that made them go, you know what, not going to do that anymore, not going to put myself in that place.
So you mentioned class. So is your teaching all class-based, like group, or is there one-on-one? Is it online? Why don't you go into how you guys have it set up?
Absolutely. So we have a certification, like I referred to, as the Certified Dementia Communication Specialist. To become that, it comes in two versions. So it can be 2 days in person. You get to spend 16 hours with us.
Oh, that's so
cool. And then after that 2 days, then you're certified. We also offer that as an online version. That was very difficult for us to come to that conclusion to do it because there's so much that we can do hands-on versus online. But what we've done is we kind of, it's a hybrid class, I would say, where they can get the manual online, they can work through case studies online, they have to go out and do this, the dementia challenges. And then we have 3 video calls that are mandatory for them to attend, where we actually work them through, they can ask us questions, that type of thing. Those are on a rotating basis. Mm-hmm. So a couple of Fridays, a couple of Saturdays during the month, they can pick and choose which they can fit into their schedule. The other thing that we've created is something that's called the Dementia Communications Essentials. And this was actually, we were awarded a grant from the Alzheimer's Foundation of America to take all this training that we have for professionals and package it in a way for family members. So we have an online version of that coming. It's still in the works at the moment. I am the tech person, so it's on me to work this out. But then the other piece of that is what we've been doing is we've done a train the trainer program where someone that has already gotten their certification can come in and take this train the trainer program, then go out into the universe, into the world, and provide this training to family members.
So the certification you're talking about, first responders, people in facilities that deal with it, hospitals, doctors,
anybody at all.
Yes.
Yep. Okay. Our youngest CDCS was 16 years old.
Okay.
So it's when open to it, anybody.
Yeah. But then you're developing the family member
thing. Right. Okay. Yeah. You know, we actually do have a couple of family members that are CDCSs that got the certification, but we didn't have the DCE at the time. So this is just, it's not as time intensive for the families because we know they're often taking care of someone with dementia, but we can still get them the skills that they need in a shorter period of time.
Right. Right.
Okay. So I heard you mention when we were setting up, you wanted to listen to some podcast or something, some audio. So is there any audio seminar you guys have been to that have given you a big aha moment that you've put into action?
I would say there is. It was actually a conference we attended. It was an international conference. It was held in Canada at the time. And this was something, the aha moment came for us because it enlightened us that what we're doing is so needed. What we saw at this international conference was we saw experts in the field get up and present their findings and then talk about the holes in their findings, a specific area of study that they were struggling to fill in that gap. And so their findings weren't 100%. Then the very next speaker that got up actually spoke about the whole as their expertise, but the previous speaker had already left the room. And so we saw this over a 3-day period of time. We saw expert after expert get up, present their findings, talk about the holes that they needed filled, but leave the room before anyone else could speak and talk to the holes that needed to be filled. And so what we saw was an absolute lack of collaboration. And the aha moment came for us in that is that why are we still struggling to find a cure for this? Because experts aren't talking to each other. They're so consumed with their own research that at least in that moment for those 3 days, that's what it appeared to be. They were so consumed with their own research that they really, their agenda in that was stronger than their agenda to really solve the bigger problem.
They didn't relinquish their agenda
at all.
Well, and I think that comes down to in a lot of research across any field, it's all about the green. It's about the money.
Yes.
And if you follow that, you know.
Yep. If you don't publish, you perish. And that was what we saw. Yeah. And that was very disheartening because for us, I think we're humanitarians. We're social experimenters by nature. And so we see the bigger picture that needs to be fixed. And that was very disheartening. So that was a huge aha moment for us, I think, in a lot of ways.
Yeah, absolutely.
Cool.
I think the other podcast that I've listened to and that you've talked about a lot is your podcast. And prior to us diving into this work, one of the things that Tammy did is she interviewed a gentleman who was in the early stages of dementia, was still able to ambulate, get out, drive his own car, and went out and got a burger at a burger joint for lunch. But in the process of ordering, he became very overwhelmed in the restaurant. The font was very small on the board. There was a lot of noise going on. And when he was in the process of trying to order at the counter, he lost his ability to find the right words. And the order taker became so frustrated with him because he wasn't moving at the pace she wanted that she became frustrated, got angry, ended up calling the police. And the police came, things escalated, and possibly, we're not quite sure, but it is very possible that gentleman ended up in handcuffs, which to me, as a podcast, that was very exemplary of why this is such an issue. It was the approach, the approach, the approach. Time and time again, we saw something that should never have happened because someone wasn't willing to relinquish their agenda and take the time and be patient with someone who was struggling.
Right.
That a kid I went to high school with, who's now deceased, but he was undiagnosed Parkinson and actually was arrested for something that, you know, nothing. He wasn't doing anything. He was with a significant other. I don't remember all the circumstances, but he ended up in cuffs, arrested, going to jail, like spending the weekend in jail, 48 hours or something. And then it was like 2 weeks later that he was diagnosed with Parkinson's and then eventually died from it. But it's crazy that you said that because that was exactly, he didn't know how to communicate with somebody else. And
yeah, we're unfortunately starting to see more of the senior arrests happen. And, you know, some of these types of dementia, such as frontotemporal degeneration, there's a whole change in their personality. And they don't often get diagnosed until something like an arrest happens because, you know, this whole personality change happens and they're doing things that they never used to do before. And there's nothing that's done because they're not quite sure what's happening. You know, is dad drinking more? You know, what's going on? You know, looking at things like that instead of a brain disorder that could be causing that change in personality. Right. So we're starting to unfortunately see, you know, someone with dementia out and that communication falls and causes so many things to escalate. And now they're getting arrested.
Right.
So it's something that we don't wish to see.
No.
And I think what helps me feel a little bit better is we're starting to see a little bit more of this in the United States is the dementia-friendly concepts. Now, within the UK, it's like all over the place. Communities are really grabbing onto this concept of a dementia-friendly community. And that's where waitresses and anybody in that community is starting to learn how to communicate with persons that are slightly different from us.
Yeah.
You know, whether it's dementia, whether it's autism, whether it's Down syndrome, whatever that might be. And so that we can hopefully avoid those arrests and things of that nature in the future.
Yeah. Long way to go, but definitely you guys are moving it in the right direction.
Thank you.
We're trying it one little tick at a time.
Yeah. So is there anything we didn't talk about that you guys want to bring up?
We talked a lot.
We did.
I don't know. I can't think of anything.
Do we want to mention a class we have coming up?
Go for it.
We can always mention a class that we have coming up. Yeah. So we do have within the Illinois area, just across the border from us, we do have our Train the Trainer class coming up at the end of July. And then in August, we have our certification class coming up also in LaGrange Park, Illinois. And that's on August 20th and 21st. And we'll be in Minnesota.
That's right.
On August 6th and 7th with our certification program
as well.
That's
right. That's right. So we try to take this everywhere we can. And what we try to do definitely is get into communities, long-term care communities. And our focus is top down. Management needs to be bought into these concepts, live and breathe in these concepts, and then exemplify them for their staff as we start to train their staff. So again, everybody's on the same page, using the same language. And what that's going to do ultimately is build confidence in someone's ability to communicate and create connection. That's our goal.
It also gives them an in-house resource to go to. Hey, I don't think this went well.
Absolutely.
Can you help me?
We love that. Yeah. And we love when an administrator will say that to a CNA. I don't think this went well. Would you mind helping me? Because what would build more confidence in someone who's a CNA than to have their own administrator come up to them and say, I might have made a mistake, but right. I know you're really good at this.
Yeah.
Now they're
yeah.
living and breathing in every one of those concepts. They're making that partner look good. They're building that confidence. They're using yes, and they're taking everything that they've learned as a gift.
Absolutely. Awesome.
So all that stuff on a website, Facebook, where can people find you?
Absolutely. So they can go to our website, dementiaraw.com, R-A-W. You can find a list of our classes. You can find all of our free downloads. So we know everybody that's listening to us wants to do the dementia challenge.
That's right.
And you can find them on our website. They're free to download. So we have two versions. So we have the original version, and we just recently challenged someone, Eversound, which created some great headphones for those that are hearing impaired. We challenged them to come up with some challenges themselves. So we have a hearing loss set of challenges as well. So
there's actually 11 you can download.
Yeah, there's 11 you can download, go out into the world. We have a Facebook group for that. So you can go in and see what other people have done. All of that information is right on our website. So we've got Facebook. We do Facebook Live all the time.
Yep.
We're on Instagram. We don't tweet as much as we should, but I'm not, you know.
All at Dementia Raw?
Yes, all at Dementia Raw.
Awesome.
Find us there.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Cool.
Hey guys, real quick before you go. First of all, I hope you enjoyed today's episode. And if you could please head over to iTunes or Stitcher and give us a review. Positive or negative, we're always looking for feedback, how to make the show better. And on that note, if you think you'd be a great guest on the show, or you know someone that might be a great guest on the show, let us know who they are, who you are. Come on over, ask NWI, that's asknwi.com/guest. Give us some details of why you think you might be a good fit or they might be a good fit. We'll hook up, see if our paths can connect in the future, and possibly get you on the show. So with that being said, we hope to see you back here next time. And as always, go practice.